Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. Tonight's author on tour is Allegra Goodman, who reads from and discusses her new novel, Intuition, published by Dial Press. In the weeks to come, we have John Grogan, Rita Mae Brown, Francis Mays, Jody Picot, Christopher Moore, and many more. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it's my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Of Allegra Goodman's new book, Intuition, NPR critic Maureen Corrigan says it's one of those novels that can make a reader excited about the art of the fiction. We're delighted that Allegra has returned to us at the Tattered Cover tonight. Would you please join me in making her feel welcome and warm?
Hi, thank you so much for coming. It's pretty nasty out there, so I was expecting three people, so I'm very happy. Can you all hear me in the back there on the couch? Okay. Looks like a really comfy place to sit. My favorite part of Maureen Corrigan's review of my book was where she said that basically she wanted to use my book as weapon of choice to beat people over the head with who don't read fiction. That made me very happy. I just pictured her sort of running around beating people over the head with my book. You know, it's a nice, solid hardback book, so get a few cracks in. Well, it's been a while since I've been here. Some of you might know some of my other books. I'm the author of two collections of stories, Total Immersion and The Family Markowitz, and two other novels, Catterskill Falls and Paradise Park. Paradise Park and Catterskill Falls deal with some of the varieties of religious experience in the Jewish American community. And my new book, Intuition, is a bit of a departure for me, a little bit of a jump in terms of my subject matter. And it was inspired by a desire to write about scientists. Now, why would I want to write about scientists? I certainly wasn't very good at science in school, but there was a number of reasons why I chose scientists, particularly biologists and cancer researchers, as my topic in this book. The first reason was that I'm surrounded by scientists, both in my family and in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I live. My husband is a computer scientist, which is a little different from a biologist. And he often asked me as I was writing this book why I didn't choose to write about computer scientists. He said, I could help you with that, you know. And he's still holding out for me to write what he calls the novel of the geek. He teaches at MIT, so he knows a lot about geeks. My sister is a biologist and an oncologist. She's a doctor who works in a research lab with zebrafish. And my brother-in-law is a computational biologist. My mother was a geneticist, and I just have many scientists in my family. I also live in Cambridge, home of MIT and Harvard and many other research institutes, and Novartis and huge drug companies and small biotech companies, and I'm just surrounded by biological research. So that was one of the reasons I turned to this as a topic. I've also been very jealous over the years of those close collaborative work relationships that scientists have with each other as they work in the lab. And this is probably because I work alone at my desk. I'm a solitary writer. And, you know, I could certainly argue with myself until I'm blue in the face, but at the end of the day, I'm going to be sitting there alone at my desk struggling with my work. And I've always been jealous of those scientists who toss ideas back and forth to one another and debate things and work closely with each other in laboratories. Of course, close collaborative work relationships also come with a fair amount of dysfunction, abuse, generational conflict, and tension, which are all great subjects for fiction. Third reason I was interested in writing about scientists is their importance in the world. I believe in the extreme usefulness and nobility of scientific work, especially biological research, which has applications to drug therapies for the terrible diseases that still plague people in America and around the world. And I was fascinated by the extreme pressures that scientists are under. pressures of scarce time and scarce money, which cause conflict and competition among scientists and among laboratories. One of the things that I could see, even from my husband, who is in a different field, is the constant need for scientists to find funding for extremely expensive work. Much of the funding comes from the government, which causes interesting tensions, which we've seen played out over time. And there's, you know, also there's a concern with getting work done quickly in science, in not being scooped by your rivals at other laboratories or in other cities when you're trying to publish first. So all of this kind of tension and conflict, all great subjects for fiction. And finally, I was fascinated with the rituals in the laboratory, with the hierarchies there, with the kind of professional family that develops there. And with the generational conflicts that are natural to laboratories, where the senior scientists have to extract work out of those junior to them, and the younger scientists struggle to make their name so that they can go out and set up their own shop. Ritual, hierarchy, generational conflict are all themes that I've dealt with in my fiction, in Catterskill Falls, in Paradise Park, The Family Markowitz, and they're all here in this book as well. So I want to just introduce you to the four main characters in my book, Intuition, and say a little bit about them. There are two older characters in my book who are the lab co-directors, the principal investigators of the lab. The first lab director is Marion Mendelssohn, who is a quiet, shy perfectionist in her 50s. And this is the way I introduce Marion in the book. Marion had been a lithe young scientist once, a beautiful, impulsive girl who earned a PhD at 25 and imagined Harvard would hire her just for her elegant work in crystallography. She had been quick to smile, joyous in her facility as carbon structures opened up to her, each in turn lovely and elliptical. The scientific world had seemed to her then translucent, sparkling, orderly as the Peabody Museum's collection of glass flowers. But there was no job for her at Harvard. A sly postdoc named Arthur Ginsburg got a position there instead. And Marion almost came to believe what others said of her, that her papers were repetitive, descriptive, and nothing more. She scrambled to find a place for herself and the means to carry on her work, and when she ended up at the Philpott Institute, she came as a pauper and had to switch fields. She knew the misery of starting over. After years of ceaseless competition, she'd grown thin and patient, critical of herself and others. Anyone who worked for Marion tensed at her glance and dreaded her questions, never rhetorical, never dramatic, but quietly devastating in their acuity. With one pointed query, she could lift the paint off the best ideas to reveal the rotting suppositions underneath. And so she's a tough cookie. Her co-director, Sandy Glass, is Marion's opposite in many respects. He's an ebullient oncologist, a brilliant publicist, and a grant-getter. And while Marion has devoted her life to basic research, Sandy has devoted his life to treating patients. And he's in many ways the front man in the lab. He's the one who works on getting grants, while Marion sort of minds the store at home. And he's a publicist. He has a gift for publicity and public speaking, which complements Marion, who hates getting up in front of people. So here's how I introduce Sandy. Sandy's features were coarse, his mouth wide, his forehead the more prominent because he had so little hair left. His nose began well, but drooped at the end. His cheeks were red with rosacea. With Sandy, however, the rules of attraction did not apply. He had a quality that went much farther than youth or beauty, an irresistible liveliness that seemed to override cynicism and doubt, a self-confidence occasionally unbearable, but in many cases deeply reassuring. Had he not enjoyed the benefit of a medical education, it's doubtless Sandy would have been an extraordinary salesman like his father, Irving. Shoes, hardware, large appliances, and Israel bonds would have flown like doves from his hands. As it happened, Sandy's sparkling savoir-faire made him a stellar oncologist. He radiated hope to every patient. Instead of death, he dwelt on baseball games and the Boston Marathon. He asked terminally ill investment bankers about the stock market, joked that they should give him tips. He focused on the day-to-day, never on the eternal, and his patients loved him for it. He wasn't going to give up on them and turn spiritual. He was an old-fashioned doctor, fighting tooth and nail against disease. Patients came to him from all over the world, tycoons and Saudi princes, even other doctors. His overworked residents called him a VIPologist, and there was some truth to this. Still, no one could deny his gifts. No one played the endgame against cancer as Sandy did. He set himself squarely against every cancerous cell, and so inspired his patients into battle, that magically, even the most sophisticated believed that he would never fail them. Their worry was that in dying, they might fail him. Now, there are two of younger main characters in this book. There are several postdocs who work in the lab, but one of them is sort of the star of the lab, and his name is Cliff Banneker. He came into the lab, and he's tall, handsome, blonde from California, and he was everyone had high hopes for him because he had done such stellar work as a graduate student. Marion and Sandy really thought when he came in that he would, you know, bring the results to the lab that they had been waiting for. And after years of struggle, in this book, in my book, it seems that he has now made a huge breakthrough with a virus he has genetically engineered to attack cancer cells in mice. Everyone is incredibly excited about Cliff's discovery, except for one person, who is his girlfriend, Robin, who is just as smart as Cliff, just as bright, just as talented, just as dedicated, and has struggled for even longer than he has. And she does not understand why he suddenly has all the luck. She's at first amazed by Cliff's success, then resentful, and finally becomes convinced that his results are just too good to be true. So the passage that I'm going to read to you tonight, Robin is at her cousin's wedding, and her thoughts turn to the lab, which is now empty because everyone in the lab is at the picnic at Walden Pond, and she's just consumed by doubt in Cliff and his results. As the last cars were loaded and the coolers drained of melted ice at Walden Pond, Robin was marching down the aisle in Phillips Congregational Church in Watertown on the arm of a groomsman named Tom. At the altar, as rehearsed, she and Tom separated, and Robin took her place in line with the five other bridesmaids. Like them, she carried a white nosegay, and like them, wore seafoam green taffeta dress with a tight bodice and full skirt, a sash tied in an oversized bow at the back, and puffed sleeves the size of giant melons. She tried to think happy thoughts. And I should emphasize that this book is set in the 1980s, and that is a period 1980 bridesmaid dress. So I do my research, and I care very much about historical accuracy. She thought about how beautiful the church looked in the late afternoon light, with its white walls and dark wood pews. She considered how lovely her auburn-haired cousin looked walking up the white cloth runner. Carolyn's train streamed and rippled over the steps to the altar as she stood there with the groom, and she seemed to glow to her fingertips. Robin thought how glad she was that her father and her uncle had started speaking to each other once again, and that there was peace in the family, at least for a while. And then inexorably, her mind turned to Cliff. She could not stop questioning his data in her mind. There had been a time she'd searched his face to judge his moods. She'd watched him watch other friends, or even women he hardly knew, and wondered constantly what he felt and thought. Now, however, she was consumed with curiosity about what he'd done. She had her own off-print of his journal article, and she must have read it 20 times. She knew by heart the shape of every column on the page and the placement of every figure. His data on the article looked fine, but the data were more than fine. They were spectacular. Too good to be true. She was horrified at herself, that just a granule of skepticism and resentment could swell like this inside of her. Even now, in church, at her cousin's wedding, her imagination raced ahead. No one was at the lab. Everyone was driving back from Walden Pond. Mendelssohn and Glass would head home, and the researchers would meet for burgers at Elsie's, as they always did. The lab was empty, and Cliff's paperwork was there to read. What a strange fever had taken hold of her. At the reception with the band playing and the family all around her, even then in every lull, suspicion washed back over her. She stood apart. She was the only scientist in the family, famously erudite and famously single. Her interminable postgraduate studies were a source of bemused pride to her dad, who often wondered aloud when she would get a real job. Her life in Cambridge was the subject of much talk among her cousins, who had just about given up trying to fix Robin up with friends. Even now in the white reception tent, the cousins urged her on and pressed her forward in the crush as Carolyn prepared to throw her bouquet. But Robin did not want the flowers and stayed diffidently on the fringes of the crowd. Carolyn turned her back on the girls and threw her bouquet over her head, and the bridesmaid screamed and the flower girls shrieked and jumped up the way Robin had seen dogs on the common jump up to catch tennis balls in their mouths. One of the little girls caught the beribboned prize, and the bridesmaids turned away, smiling but slightly disappointed, toward their boyfriends. "I didn't see you trying very hard over there," her father teased. "Sorry, Dad," she told him. "I guess I'll just have to be an old maid." "Don't say that." He dabbed his perspiring face with his handkerchief. He was flushed and overweight, hot in his suit. She worried about her father and pestered him often about going on a diet and quitting smoking and getting a stress test. She was afraid he would get lung cancer or emphysema, and more immediately that he had hypertension. But he never listened to her when she went on about these matters. Maddeningly, he always said, "You can start giving me medical advice when you have a medical degree." And then Robin's stepmother would jump to his defense. "I like your style," Robin told Lynn once. "I like the way you stand up for Dad and defend his right to die." Robin despaired for her father, but she loved him. She had no patience for her stepmother. When all the toasts were said and the dancing done, Tom drove Robin back to Cambridge. "Just tell me where," he said, and she guided him through Harvard Square, up Broadway to Felton Street. "This is it?" he asked uncertainly, as he gazed at the Philpott Institute. "Thanks, this is perfect," she told him, and hurried out. "I just have to check some stuff at the lab." "Nice outfit," the guard told Robin as she sprinted past in her bouffant dress. She flushed but didn't stop. She pushed open the heavy doors that led to the back passageway and ran up the stairs to the second floor with its peculiar smell of ammonia and pencil shavings in linoleum tiles. Its linoleum tiles checked black and green like the mottled covers of composition books. Up again on the black stairs, her heels clanged on the metal treads and her nosegay of white roses flopped and drooped. She threw it down on the table in the lounge. Darting inside the lab, she flicked on the fluorescent under-cabinet lights and found her copy of the journal article on her desk. Then she reached for Clip's lab book and riffled through its alternating white and yellow pages, devouring the numbers there. She had looked at most of this before, but now she compared his notes to the printed data in the article. Her heart was galloping, her lungs cramped and strained at the tight bodice of her dress. "There is nothing here," she told herself. Still, she checked the numbers in each table. Meticulous as a scientific bookkeeper, she combed through the raw data and final draft. Line by line, she audited Cliff's accounts. She took a deep breath and closed the book. There were no discrepancies. She turned the lights off and stood uncertainly for a moment in the darkened lab. Her trepidation faded. Her huge anticipation sank away. She walked deliberately down the hall, and then she walked a little faster. Her shoes clicked on the hard floor, faster and faster. Her heels ticked down the stairs to the first floor exit as she ran to the animal facility. As Robin unlocked each door downstairs, her dress billowed about her knees, the synthetic fabric rustling around her like a shower curtain. Frantic though she felt, she paused at the lockers and donned lab coat and hairnet. She peeled disposable booties from the stack and slipped one over each pump. She was not afraid of the eerie light or squirming animals, the faint smell, the kitchen refrigerator that served as morgue, all the more gruesome for its ordinary white and chrome, its butter compartment and crisper drawers, and even the snack drawers meant for cheeses stuffed with stiff mouse bodies in their body bags. She was not afraid of the scuffling mice, the wounded animals staining each other as they fought. She feared none of this. She was afraid of herself for rushing down so desperately. In search of what? Evidence? That Cliff was not as lucky or as talented as everybody thought. In the animal room, she turned on the examining light and took down the clipboards that hung from the cage racks. She pored over the registry of births and deaths and procedures in between. The notations were all routine, whether in Cliff's scrawl or Fung's firm block letters. She peered at the nude mice in their cages. Generations had come and gone since March, and any surviving animals from then were old and blind. She would go home. She would forget all this. Still, she slipped into one last room. The dissection room was unusually neat, the table clear except for its polystyrene dissecting pad. The drawers underneath were locked, but Robin knew where the key was kept and opened them one by one. Trays of rusty pins emerged, boxes of extra gloves and black plastic bags, and there in the bottom drawer, a messy pile of papers, mostly scratch, along with a couple of thin-line permanent markers. Robin's fingers trembled as she held up the pages to the examining light. There was Cliff's handwriting, sloping, spiky, unmistakable, on three pages ripped from a spiral notebook. She could not tell if these were just draft notes for his experiments in the journal article or some other set. Then on the second page she saw a notation for injection with R7 and the date March 21st. She began to run down the hall, her heels sliding in the slippery booties. She pulled them off, tossed her hairnet. She dumped her lab coat in an open laundry bin. Then she pulled her shoes off altogether and began racing up the stairs in her stocking feet, carrying keys, journal article, 3 pages of data, and her dyed satin shoes. She sprinted for the first floor photocopier. Thank you. Well, if anyone has any questions, I'd be delighted to answer them. Yes. Thank you. Did you all hear the question? Yeah. I enjoy writing both short stories and novels, and I still write both. In fact, I just finished a new short story like a week ago. I don't have a preference. They're really different. The good thing about a short story is sort of instant gratification or almost instant gratification. You know, you can write one in a week. Or in my case, you could try writing one for 1 week, then try it again another week, and then in the third week, figure out what you're doing and then write it. So, I have false starts, but it's a lot faster. And, this novel took me 4 years to write. It's a bit more of a marathon. It's a different form. And a short story is every word counts, and every gesture, and every action, every little piece of dialogue, it's fitted together. It's more like a poem. A novel is, you have much more room to expand, and you can develop more complicated ideas in a novel. You can write about people through a longer period of time in a novel. So it's just a question of doing different things. And my favorite thing, perhaps, is to write to do both at once, which is to write a cycle of short stories which are interconnected, as I did in The Family Markowitz. So some people read that book as a book of short stories, and some people read it as a novel because there's an overarching narrative. So that's probably my favorite way to write short stories, as interlocking, each standing alone and yet also contributing to a larger narrative. Other questions? Yes, over here. good question. I wanted to write about biologists, and I wanted to be able to dramatize the scientific process for a non-technical reader. And so I had the idea of writing about animal research, because people working with animals, those procedures are dramatic and primitive and visceral, and it's great stuff to write about, as opposed to, writing about the current techniques with DNA in the laboratory, which are highly technical and probably equally dramatic in their own way. But there was something sort of so elemental about working with animals. So I got the idea of writing about people working with mice. Since my sister works with zebrafish, I didn't want to do anything that impinged on her territory. So since I live in Cambridge, I took advantage of my own backyard and called up people at the Whitehead Institute. And finally, after several tries, got in touch with a postdoc who was willing to let me watch him work, and he introduced me to another postdoc. And after some time, when I, convincing them I wasn't an animal rights activist in disguise or anything like that, they took me down to the animal facility, and I showed them that I wasn't going to touch anything, wasn't going to photograph anything, I wasn't a journalist, wasn't going to write about their experiments and tell about them to other people. They took me down. I had my notebook, and I did drawings, and I watched them do procedures with animals. And so I based my descriptions on direct observation there, which is the only way you can really write about that kind of stuff. It was a lot of fun, actually. I would say 99% of my work in this book and in any book is imaginative, but I needed that grain of truth to take the reader in. Yes. Well, I still believe that 99.9% of scientists are, truth seekers and dedicated to finding out the truth. It's that small minority. There is a small minority who, unfortunately, have cheated in the past and have been exposed. I don't think it's a huge number of people. So that said, I still believe most scientists really are seeking the truth. Now, with Dr. Wang, what insights might I have in the South Korean thing? Well, first of all, I was so amazed. I wrote this book, I started this book 4 years ago. I had it all planned out. So, of course, I had no idea that particular scandal would erupt, although there have been other scandals over time. I think there's a lot of, in his case, there's a huge amount of pressure on scientists. There's the expectations of a whole country, in his case, in South Korea. He was even put on a stamp, and he fed into that. I think that ultimately that the people who lie, the scientists who lie, are people who are lying to themselves, and they come to tell themselves a story that they believe. And that's the only way that it all works. The other interesting thing that happens is that these scientists are working with many other people who form a network of belief and trust around them. They can't, you know, they don't do it completely alone, but there's sort of a complicity of the community around them, that until actually the data starts to unravel, these people are surrounding them and you know, making it seem that this work is valid. So I don't have a lot of, I mean, I'm not a scientist, certainly, but as a novelist who, you know, my contribution is that I can sort of, that I can talk about motivations because I can get inside of characters. You know, my insight would be that he is somebody who lied to himself as well as to other people. And actually, I'd be interested to, I don't know if you've read my book yet, but I'd be interested to see what you think, as you know, of the ending of my book. Anything else? Yes. How did I come up with the title? Well, the question of, I think intuition is extremely important in science and in art. You know, a scientist, to a certain extent, has to interpret data. And there is a way that a scientist has to use intuition to, you know, find that pattern and find what's significant. Now, the question then becomes, you know, there's a fine line between choosing the significant data and between that and applying, you know, preconceived notions and forcing data into a certain pattern. And the theme of intuition is sort of throughout this book, not only with Cliff and his intuitive, very natural ideas about where his experiments should go, but Robin's intuition that he cheated, and sort of where do we trust our intuition, and where should we doubt it? At one point, you know, Robin thinks that as a scientist, you know, in all her years of training, she's been trained to sort of rein in her intuition. That, you know, intuition is something that, you know, perhaps a master scientist could, you know, or a principal investigator could use, but that younger people were trained not to trust their intuition, lest, like the sorcerer's apprentice, they flood the lab with their conceits. So it's a dangerous and tricky quality, and important in this book. In the back, they're on the couch. Yeah, that's been really, really interesting. My first feedback that I got was a review of a book that ran in Slate. I don't know if any of you saw it, but it was by Dr. Jerome Groopman, who's a very distinguished oncologist and scientist. And he actually said, you know, he thought the book was authentic, so I was very excited about that. Actually, I should say, before the review process, I showed this book to several scientist friends and had them read the manuscript, and, you know, I just asked them, are there terrible mistakes here? Does this look plausible to you? Is this working here? One of my friends, Tom Schwartz, has his own lab at Children's Hospital in Boston, and he read the whole thing. And he encouraged me early on. He caught some little things, but he also encouraged me early on with his email, with a long email in which he said he got to about page 50 of the book when Cliff was presenting his amazing results to the whole lab and everybody sitting around the conference table, and his fellow postdocs are kind of smiling nervously and, you know, trying to, really hard to be happy for them. But in that moment, you know, their relationship with him has become much more complex. They had been in sort of this fellowship of failure together and suffering and, you know, going nowhere. And all of a sudden, he has been sort of elevated among them. And they're sort of wondering what this means for them. And they have very, very mixed emotions. And he said when he got to that moment and that scene, he said that's where he felt like he knew those people. They were in his building. So so it's been, you know, it's been really interesting. One of the postdocs that I spent time with early on when I did my research said to me, you know, when I came into his lab, you know, what you need to capture in your book, Allegra, is the bitterness of this experience. And I was like, I said to him, you know, Jonathan, I can do bitter. You know, I'm a novelist, but could I please see your mice? You know, like, I wanted to do very concrete things. So actually, I've been really pleasantly surprised that people seem to be quite interested. And my husband, the computer scientist, has found on various scientific blogs people talking about my book, which he's shown me. quite detailed, you know, but in general, you know, I can't complain. It seems like people think the psychology of it, excuse me, especially, somehow rings true. In the front here. Oh, absolutely. Good point. Yeah, lying, unfortunately, I seem to have really tapped into a big theme here, lying. And it happens in many fields. And, you know, right about the time when Dr. Wang's stuff, lies, were coming out, we had the Fry episode, you know, with Oprah Winfrey, where this whole memoir turned out to be fabricated. So in the literary community, you also see it. Then there's this fascinating thing with the J.T. Leroy scandal, in which this author doesn't even exist. Like, first the facts in this guy's memoir don't exist. Then the author himself doesn't exist. You know, I mean, it just goes on and on. So it seems that I have tapped into a perennial topic. You know, who knew? You know, lying is so topical. You know, so unfortunately, this is the, you know, it's the way of the world. I think, you know, again, you know, there's a place for the smokinggun.com to expose people. There's a place for journalism to talk about lying and fraud and the accusations of fraud, which are not always correct. Also, that other wrinkle of, you know, can we trust the exposers and what are their motivations? And then there's, you know, as a novelist, the thing that I can add is to write about all of this from the inside, not from the outside, so that my perspective is I write about the story, you know, from many sides of the story and from the inside of many of each of these sides. So it's an interesting kind of geometry in fiction. And, you know, I knew from the beginning that was sort of what I could add. Yes. The most challenging part of the book, I guess initially it was perhaps getting access to laboratories to see what, you know, that just took me a long time because I didn't want to impose on my friends and relatives. I didn't want to get my sister fired, that kind of thing. You know, you have to be careful when you're a novelist. People don't always want to tell you their inmost secrets. So that was an initial hurdle. And then secondly, this is my most ambitious book, and it's an intricate plot, and it's a suspenseful plot, and getting the pacing right of it, I spent a lot of time revising, and the characters were always really clear to me. Before I start writing, I write biographies of each of the main characters, and so I felt that I really knew them. But I would say the pacing and the revision and getting it into this form where it just moves along, where you pick it up and, you know, it just takes you, you know, that where the book becomes not just a lumpy object but a vehicle for the imagination, that's hard work. Fortunately, I like revising, and I've got a wonderful editor, Susan Camel, who worked with me on editing it for quite a while. This book, I would say that I spent a year on the research and the floundering, a year on the first draft, a year on the second draft, and then a year editing the whole thing again. So sometimes what happens with me is sort of the best parts of the book are there from the beginning and don't change. But other parts of the book could be rewritten, you know, 15 times. But it's okay. It's all a labor of love, you know. It's a work of art, you know. So I treated it, you know, I felt that I was going to take as long as it took to get it right. Ah, he's asking me what happened to the whistleblower? I'm not telling the ending of my book. My gosh. You're going to have to read it. You absolutely. This is one thing I want to tell you guys. Read the last 50 pages really carefully. Uh-huh. That's absolutely right. I'm fascinated by the whole whistleblower phenomenon. You know, what it all means and what happens to the whistleblower and the character of Robin, and it's a really it's a study in all of that. So, I think you'll be really interested in that bit. But you're very sneaky, and I'm not going to tell you the end. It's just not going to happen. Over here. Well, thank you. I really appreciate what your comment, and what can I say? I'm doing my job. It's my job to do that. I work out my imagination every day. In the front, right here. I started writing when I was 7 years old and just wrote stories ever since I was a kid and always wanted to be a writer. And so, you know, by high school I was really seriously writing. In college I started publishing short stories in Commentary magazine, mostly about Jewish themes, and an agent who was just starting out at the time ripped my magazines out of the my stories out of the magazine and called me up one day in my dorm in college and said, I'm just starting out as an agent, and would you be interested in my trying to sell a collection of your stories? And I was like, sure. I mean, she was the only agent who called me. So I was like, I mean, what could you look? You know, I didn't know who she was. I had no idea, you know. So I said, okay, and she sold that book, and that was my first book. And actually, that agent, Irene Skolnick, and I have been together ever since. It's been, I'm 38 now, so, and we started working when I was 20. It's been 18 years. So, you know, the business, for, you know, in terms of, like, advice about the business, I would say the main thing is keep reading, reading, reading all the time. Write short stuff as well as long stuff. If you've got, people have said, I've been working on a novel for a really, really long time, and it's not, you know, I'm having trouble with it. Always have a plan B. Work, have another book in the back burner. You know, do some other things, some short things as well. Send stuff out to literary journals and little magazines. Just keep. But the main thing is to have the stuff, you know. When I sold my first short story, well, the first story I submitted to the commentary, you know, I don't know if the woman knew how old I was, but she said, you know, Mrs. Goodman, it's very interesting, and this doesn't really work for us right now, but we'd love to see more of your work. And, of course, it's the only story I had written, so I immediately went down and, you know, wrote another one right away and sent it out to her. So, you know, good to have a backlog of stuff. So when they say, let's see some more, you know, you're ready. You can't sell anything if you don't write anything, so. I went to Harvard. So how about one more question? Wait, way in the back. Was that you with your hand? Oh, he's... Okay, you on the couch. Deborah Solomon. This is a this has been a popular question. Deborah Solomon, how was my interview with her? She does the questions for a thing in the New York Times magazine on Sunday where they have the mugshot of you from head to toe, which I have to say is completely terrifying as a writer who is used to working in her pajamas. And, you know, getting phone calls, don't forget to wear nice shoes. They're going to have your shoes in the picture. So the picture was almost as terrifying as being interviewed by her. I did, like, several hours with her. It's amazing. She's a very thorough. She read this whole book. She loved the book, which sort of set me at ease. But, you know, she read the book, and she interviewed me for about 3 hours just in our first conversation. It was all for 700-word interviews, and she's very smart, but she's an aggressive questioner, and you know, she pushes because she likes to have, she's an artist, and she likes to have those pithy one-line responses, and she likes to push, and she likes to be aggressive. She doesn't mind seeming aggressive in her interviews. So the good news for me was that the second day after the interview, she goes into editing mode, and she actually goes over every line of the interview with her subject, which is incredibly gracious. And she said to me right off the bat, if you don't like something in here, one of your answers, you know, you can actually change it. So I was like, you know, this is a huge sigh of relief. And of course, since I do so much revision and everything, I got very comfortable in editing mode to the point where I was like, Deborah, instead of saying by contrast, I think you should say in contrast. You know, she was like, I just maybe got a little too comfortable there. But I got really used to it. So, you know, I understood what she was doing. She was pushing me really, really hard to get the best product that she could, and then she was going into editing mode. So I was a little scared at the beginning, but happy at the end. So thank you so much. I'd love to sign anybody's books.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod-tuned in the coming weeks for John Grogan, Rita Mae Brown, Francis Mays, Jody Picot, Christopher Moore, and many more as we podcast Authors on Tour. This podcast was originally recorded on March 20th, 2006.